Come on. miss you.
Friend of mine always said, Victoria always the teller. Said to she marred this divine grace of Maya. Chananad about the banana ghost army. She left one bard. She's gone down to the chariot. She left one bard, and the goatee portion of the vijay. Nama chariot, Shahrita, Stahu, vijay. Spread the sake of Hope, Sri Krishna. Chaitanya Prabhu, Nichan, and this is way to get our time. Shiva City Go, Bhakta, Vrindikajai, Shishi, Radhakrishna, Govardhana, Sain Kunda, Radhakunda, Giri Govardhan, Kijai, Vrindavanam, Kijai, Vajiranam, Kijai, Navadiktam, Kijai, Jagadvasnami, Kijai, Purumai, Kijai, Shimadi Lasi, Devi, Kijai, Sankveda, Bhakta, Vrindikajai, Gaur, Premananda, all glories the assemble the devotees. All glories the assemble the devotees. All glories the assemble the devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Gauranga Srila Prabhupada Kijai. So, my own Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya. Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Bhadanta Swami Namani Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauranga. Neither say Shushinyavadi Paschacha days of time. Everyone stay out of the sun. You're in the sun. Is that too much for you?
Oh, no.
It's really bright out there. Anyway, so we're going to talk about empathic communication. And I have a whole bunch of my books available if anyone's interested in getting a copy of the book. Anyway, we're not selling books. This is not the purpose of the whole thing, because I don't make any profit from the sale. Yeah, sometimes people give lectures and the whole idea is to sell something or to make some money, but I'm not, don't need it. So, anyway, so let me read a quote from Prabhupada first, just about compassion. This is from the third canto, 21st chapter. Text 31. Showing compassion to all living entities, you will attain self-realization. Giving assurance of safety to all, you will perceive your own self as well as all the universes in me and myself in you. So, wow. So, yeah, as we know, compassion, empathy are very important parts of a Vaishnava's life. Of course, we're chanting every morning, Bunja Kalpa Puru Vishja, Kripa Sindhu Vyevaja, Patitanam, Padane Vyo Vaishnava Vyo Namonabha. So a Vaishnava is a Kripa Sindhu. Kripa Sindhu means an ocean of compassion, an ocean of mercy. So we're going to describe what compassion is. So the interesting thing is, first thing we have to distinguish between compassion and sympathy, or empathy and sympathy. I think that's really important. And actually, this is like the 50th time I've given this course, so I try to do it differently each time, just so it keeps it interesting for me. Otherwise, I get bored. But if I teach the same thing every time, I go crazy, because I have a need for variety, which is really important for me. So anyway, so let's talk about the difference between sympathy and empathy. All right, let's do a demonstration. Let's do it differently this time. Okay, so Aripurusha. Your wife just yelled at you.
Yeah.
And so tell me what happened. Tell me how you feel.
I feel pretty bad.
You feel pretty bad. What did she say to you?
That I was a nonsense.
You said you were not this. Okay, so here is sympathy. Boy, I really feel bad if your wife yelled at you. You know, I had a similar experience, not with a wife, because I'm sitting down. I had a similar experience in the GBC meeting. I made a mistake and they yelled at me. So, you know, just really, I don't like getting yelled at. It's really bad. Yelling is really bad. Wives are really bad.
Irish for it to begin with. You know? Unless you... Why did you want to get tortured like that? You know, I know how you feel. That's why I've been sitting out. So... that's... not precisely sympathy. It's very close. So how do you feel now that I said that to you?
Not so good.
That didn't help you at all.
No.
Well, here's another example of sympathy. What a nonsense wife you have. I don't know why I arranged this a stupid marriage. All right, so the you don't feel so good either because you're stuck in this situation. Sorry, I mean, this is what I usually do. Use people and they illustrate things that I know I can get away with. I mean, is that, you have to know who and what you can get away with things with. Certain people I couldn't get away with. I mean, I couldn't do that with somebody, Rupa or someone else, because they're more sensitive. These people won't freak out because they know me too well. So... anyway, so all right, so let's do, so empathy is not going to be about me. The difference is sympathy is actually about, sympathy is about me, you know, my experiences, you know, I feel real bad for you. That's sympathy. Or, you know, passing judgment and things like that. So empathy would be, all right, say it again, what happened?
My wife called me nonsense.
Well, first of all, I'd use body language to address that. You know, I wouldn't say anything. And it's, phew, wow. That's really painful. That must, sounds really painful.
It's okay, I'm used to it.
Well, you don't need empathy or so. At least they're vulnerable, isn't it? This is turning into a marriage therapy session.
I'm just joking. I know.
So anyway, so, you know, it sounds painful.
Yeah, it's really tough.
You know, what do you do? Nice to have loving relationships, isn't it?
Yeah, it'd be nice to have some more of that.
So how do you feel now that I said that?
Feel better.
You feel better. Because I'm trying to get in touch with your needs. I'm not going to specifically use what's called NVC language or EC language because it drives people crazy. EC language or NVC language, let's say NVC language would be how do you feel, you know, what you need, like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I did say how you feel. But I was speaking to one of my friends who goes to, actually it's Raja Bihari, who took courses in communication and mediation and everything like that. He said, you can tell anybody who studied NVC because they have this way of speaking to you that drives you bananas. Are you feeling... because you have a need for this? And he was telling me that that is universal, because they do teach NVC also. So we're not going to do that. So we're just trying to understand somehow or other and trying to reflect his feelings and his needs. So he has a need for a loving relationship, and he's feeling, you know, really disturbed, upset, right?
Yeah, maybe look on my face doesn't indicate that.
I know, I mean, you're not so good with acting. So, anyway, so that's the difference between empathy and sympathy. So let's try to understand that we're not talking about your feelings. When you're dealing with someone else, of course, there's also self-empathy, which is really important. But we're not talking about your feelings when you're trying to help someone or you're trying to reflect someone. You're talking about them. You're actually interested in them. But before you can actually help someone, let me get tissue. Before you can actually help someone else, you have to have all your needs met, too. In other words, if I was hungry, if I was tired, I wouldn't even feel like helping you. I would just say, that's your problem, buddy. Or I would feel that it's your problem, buddy. So that's the first point. So this empathic communication we're teaching, it's very important to understand, it's not a tool to be used to manipulate people or to manage people. You know, it's sometimes it works really badly as a management tool. Because if you try to get too empathic, sometimes you're not going to be able to manage a temple properly. You're going to be left with all the deity worship. So there's a time for empathic communication, and there's a time for management. And what I think insofar as ISKCON is concerned, is that we need someone in every temple who is empathic, and we need someone who is managing who is not empathic. I mean, this is practical. I mean, this is actually Varnashram. If you look at successful models of churches, you'll see that there's always a minister, and then there's a group of people who manage the church. At least in America, it's like that with the Baptist church, the Methodist churches, and the churches like that. You'll find that the two activities are not really, cannot be executed by one person, because it's a conflict of interest. For example, if I'm someone's guru, and at the same time trying to be their temple president, is a conflict of interest. Because the guru has to be concerned with the spiritual life of the devotee, and the temple president has to be concerned with exploiting the poor guy. I'm sorry. Not really. That's just a joke. Squeezing as much out of the person. No, the temple president has to be concerned with practical management. You know, they're concerned with finances, they're concerned with getting a particular service done. And I personally don't see, in most cases, except, let's say, if you're someone like Prabhupada, how you can do both services nicely. Because you're just wearing two different hats there. And we all need... What's that?
I just wanted to ask, so in that case, people would be okay with temple president. They would be upset with that person because they would have someone to talk to.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in the business field, too, you know, you have someone who is in charge of, what is that name again?
Human resources.
Human resources, yeah. Human resources who would take care of the people in the company. And then they'd be the management structure. Apart from that, and the human resources, sometimes they have someone called an ombudsman. I don't know if you've ever heard about that. But ombudsman is someone who confidentially can talk to you, help you deal with your issues in the company, and then communicate confidentially the concerns of the employees to the boss or to the manager. And in the future, that's actually Varnashram too. Because you have Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras in Varnashram, and the Brahmins have to be someone who don't have any other interests. In other words, just helping you. They can't have any financial interests. That's why a Brahmin has to be basically without taking salary. A Brahmin has to be just really detached from everything to be able to give pure advice to people. So I see that as far as this God is concerned, if we don't morph into that situation or into that dynamic, that we're going to have trouble. Because people need to feel that someone is concerned about them. That's why, I mean, of course, we do have the guru. We have gurus in this God. and one can take shelter of gurus, but it's not always so effective because the guru may be 1,000 miles or 10,000 miles away, and it creates a problem in the ISKCON management structure when you have someone writing to their gurus complaining about the temple president. And then you have this what's called parallel lines of authority problem in ISKCON, which we've talked about before, where, and then the GBC gets complaints, the GBC has to put restrictions on the guru, don't open your mouth, you know. And of course we have that ISKCON disciple course where the guru and the temple manager or temple president is supposed to work together cooperatively for the good of the disciple. And ideally that's good. But in the practical world, it's better to have a local person. We're not talking about the guru right now. But it's better to have a local person who is empathic with you, who can actually help you. I feel like I should be on the same level. This is just, I want to be talking down to everybody. Maybe either sit here. Yeah, it's just like, it's weird if I'm trying to be empathic and actually up there, isn't it? Just looking down at all you poor souls, conditioned souls. So, the ideal situation is that locally, no, I'm fine. My load is sweet. Disciples have to see like that. So the ideal situation is that there's someone who we can go to, who we feel can counsel us, reflect our feelings and needs, someone we can trust, and someone who doesn't have any other interest. Does everyone understand that? And that's just a management, that's just a vision I have for ISKCON management or ISKCON structures in the future. Because that's, if people feel that someone cares about them and their only service is to care about them, people will stay in our society. You know, one of the main reasons people leave is because of lack of a particular need, which is loving relationships. You know, no one really cares about me here. So, anyway, that's a side note, but just a practical observation. So, let's see where we go now. So, empathy, as we've mentioned before, is basically just trying. Well, let me read what I have here. This is presence, focus, intention, caring about yourself and caring about others. It's not analyzing anyone. And it's basically being focused on your feelings and needs and on the feelings and needs of others. But first of all, you got to take care of yourself. Now, we have a problem in ISKCON, and all religious groups have a problem. And that problem is, we're going to talk about the first, what we call the D's of discommunication. The problem is that we have a very, very precise philosophy and a very, very precise way of designating people. And you will find that in many religions, in fact, all religions that I know of, where they have a scripture, not just something called a religion, but religions where they have a scripture and injunctions and designations of people, you will find a lack of empathy. And in this is borne out in a study that I'm going to cite right now. There was a person named Joseph Campbell who studied people in religious groups, and he found that 80% of people in religious groups were less compassionate than people in general, and 20% were more compassionate. And the reason for that is that in religious societies and religious groups, they have different ways of designating people or putting labels on people. Like we have so many of them,
Maybe we can do a flip chart on this. Who can write on the flip chart? Anyone capable of writing? You're operating the camera. So, like if you go to the Muslim religion, they have, you can be a kafir or an infidel. And in Christianity, what are the designations of Christianity?
Sinner.
What?
Sinner. No. I'm not sure.
What are the negative labels in Christianity? Heathen. Mm. Anyway, you got a lot. So what we're going to do right now is show just being tired is hard. So is we're going to show what you start writing. We're going to ask you all for some words that we use that designate people, so we don't see them anymore as people, as dynamic living entities, but we see them as their designations. So what designations do we have within the ISKCON movement?
Demon.
Yeah. Demon, why don't you write that down?
Karmi.
Karmi, demon.
Rascal.
Shudra.
Shudra. Muta.
Nonsense. Neophyte.
Malecha. Animal. You got it?
Blucht.
What?
Blucht.
Blucht, yeah, bloop. Fallen. Rakshasa. Fixed up. Fixed up, yeah, the positive ones too. Pure devotee. Fixed up devotee.
Mayavadi.
Yeah, we apply that to devotees sometimes.
Sahajya.
What?
Sahajya.
What about some sexist designations?
Maya Devi.
Less intelligent woman?
Maya Devi.
Oh, Maya Devi, that's a good one. There's an interesting story about that I can tell. Recently, some of the ladies started to lead kirtan in the Krishna Balaram Mandir. And then Gauramani was there. She's one of my disciples. And the men came out from the kirtan group, and they pushed them all aside. They actually took their kartels and started slamming them in front of their faces, grabbed the instruments from them, and pushed them aside. And then they were taken to the temple president's office to be chastised, the men, not the women. And the men said, "Don't you understand? You have to protect us against these Maya Devis." it's actually quite interesting. It's like blaming the food for causing you to lose control and eat too much. It's the fault of the pizza. All right, what other words do we have? We have a lot more. Yeah, positive, negative.
Yogi?
Renounced. Let's say renounced. Renounced, did you get pure devotee down? Fanatic. Mixed devotee? Okay, mixed devotee.
Spaced out.
Prabhupada disciple. Prabhupada disciple.
yes.
Okay, that's probably enough. So what we do, it's because we have all these different labels, is that when we get an impression of someone, we actually put that label on them, and then we think and see them in that way from then on. And that keeps us from seeing them as a dynamic living entity. So there's two words, static and dynamic. Static means someone always remains the same. And dynamic means that we're changing. Like sometimes we may act in such a way that's stupid. We're not stupid. Just like when I mentioned that I got a speeding ticket. So that action was stupid. But I'm hopefully not stupid. But so, but if someone puts the label on me that I'm stupid for doing that, and then people will see me as being stupid. So we do that with people. We actually put a label, we diagnose them. That's considered the first D of discommunication. We have four D's of discommunication. We diagnose them in such a way that we deal with them from then on in terms of that label. Does everyone understand that? This is really important. So religions tend to do that, or the way people utilize religions, because we're used to labels in religions. Especially in Krishna consciousness, where we have a very elaborate system of labels and very elaborate shastras. And if you look in Prabhupada's books, it's really interesting. We've been talking about that in our classes in the evening. The Prabhupada uses the word rascal in relationship to so many living entities. Scientists are rascals, you know, politicians are rascals. This person's a rascal. And people ask me that question, why is Prabhupada using that word so much? My understanding is that Prabhupada is not really seeing the person as a rascal, but Prabhupada is addressing their philosophy. Like Jesus Christ says in the Bible, you shouldn't hate the sinner, you should hate the sin. So people sometimes accuse Prabhupada of being uncompassionate because of his language. But if you look at Prabhupada's personal dealings with people, it's not that Prabhupada actually generally deals with scientists as rascals. He deals with them as people, and he's very compassionate. But he's trying to address something that's very important to his heart. And it's an emotional response to people who decry the supremacy, existence, and personality of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So when Prabhupada uses strong language, my understanding is that it's because he loves Krishna so much that anything or anyone who decries Krishna or considers the Absolute Truth to be impersonal, Prabhupada responds to emotionally. And that's what Prabhupada is doing. Not that he actually sees the person in a negative way. So Prabhupada is completely compassionate, empathic. And my experience is he dealt with everyone like that, even when he would chastise them directly to their face because of his love for Krishna. So, let's see. Okay, that's a basic introduction. And I'll skip this chapter. excuse me, because I'm a little tired now in this cold, so it's a little slower than normal. Okay, so one thing I talk about in the seminar is that we're in what Marcia Rosenberg, who I studied with, considers to be a domination culture. In a domination culture, people are doing things not out of desire to contribute, not out of a desire to meet needs, but out of a desire to avoid chastisement, or out of a desire to achieve something externally. And so we find in our society that people are generally out of touch with their feelings and needs. And because of that, they are able to be controlled and dominated by others. This is fear of authority, or trying to get something out of authority. So fear is actually built into our cultural structures. Even in ISKCON, we have a guru-disciple relationship. Parent-child shouldn't be. Parent-child relationship, the boss and the subordinate relationship. And our current culture supports imposing rewards and punishments on people to make people obedient. This is the same way that animals are trained up. I don't know if you've ever seen like dolphins or porpoises that jump in the air, and they're actually trained up by either punishment or reward. And so this particular culture that we're subjected to right now, the socio-political system, facilitates dictators, kings, autocrats, etc., and as we've recently experienced in the United States, and our past president of the United States is a culture of domination. So when we use punishments and rewards, or when the leader uses punishments and rewards, people sometimes will obey, but the cost actually is the trust and loving relationships. And then also when we do this, it trains others to deal in the same way. And when we live in an institution and we live with labels and titles, we can actually become monsters. An example of this is the Nazi rule in Germany. So that's a domination culture. And here's a verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam. It talks about how we have free will, and we should, a pure devotee like Narada Muni functions on the basis of free will, and how a need for full freedom and free will, or exercising our free will, is an important need. This is from the first canto, 6th chapter, text 37, and I'll read it. Sutta Goswami said, thus addressing Vyasadeva, Narada Muni took leave of him and, vibrating on his Veena instrument, left to wander at his free will. Srila Prabhupada states that every living being is anxious for full freedom because that is his transcendental nature. And this freedom is obtained only through the transcendental service of the Lord. Illusion by the external energy, everyone thinks that he is free, but actually he is bound up by the laws of nature. A conditioned soul cannot freely move from one place to another, even on this earth, and what to speak of one planet to another. But a full-fledged free soul like Narada, always engaged in chanting the Lord's glory, is free to move not only on earth, but also in any part of the universe, as well as any part of the spiritual sky. We can just imagine the extent and unlimitedness of his freedom, which is as good as that of the Supreme Lord. There is no reason or obligation for his traveling. and no one could stop him from his free movement. Similarly, the transcendental system of devotional service is also free. It may or may not develop in a particular person even after he undergoes all the detailed formulas. Similarly, the association of the devotee is also free. One may be fortunate to have it, or one may not have it even after thousands of endeavors. Therefore, in all spheres of devotional service, freedom is the main pivot. Without freedom, there is no execution of devotional service. The freedom surrendered to the Lord does not mean that the devotee becomes dependent in every respect. So,
what was the reference?
What's that?
What was the verse?
This is, hold on, it's first canto, sixth chapter, text 37. Okay. So this is the type of society we want, that people will be serving Krishna, preaching Krishna consciousness, in order to meet their needs, and to meet Krishna's needs, and to meet the needs of the devotees out of empathy rather than force. Krishna in the Gita does not threaten Arjuna. He presents to Arjuna the natural consequences of different actions. But he doesn't say to Arjuna that if you don't do this, I'm God, I'm going to smash you and send you to hell. Nor does he use a guilt trip. A guilt trip is something like, I'm your friend, Arjuna, and I've been your friend for so many years. How can you do this to me? Don't you understand? Everything I've done for you, I've saved your wife from being disrobed, right? I saved you from the house of lack. I've been there for you every minute of the day. And now you're not listening to me? It's like a mother would say to a child, like my mother did that, when I joined the Krishna Conscious Movement, she said, how can you do this? I raised you since you were a little baby. I carried you for 9 months. And now look what you've done to me. You joined the Hare Krishna Movement. So, this is not respecting the living entity's free will. So what Krishna does with Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, he explains to Arjuna the courses of different actions, basically. And he says to Arjuna, now that you've heard this, what do you want to do? And Arjuna, of course, says, I'm going to fight. And so this is this is how we should deal with people. Not by threats or rewards, but simply explaining the course of different actions. And the guru can do that with the disciples, just like if you listen to me, you go back to God, and if you don't, you go to hell. I'm your guru, you know, this is a mad elephant offense. No, I mean, that's basically how we should deal with people. It's up to you what you like to do. You know, the guru should be more like a facilitator than the boss. Of course, the guru does give instructions, but it's not that the guru should give instruction based upon some implicit or explicit threat. It should be, you know, my suggestion or my instruction is that you wake up early in the morning, go to Mangal Arati. And the disciple says, no. And the guru says, that's your decision, buddy. Because, I mean, if you really want to be Krishna conscious, here's the method to do it. That's all. It's not that I'm going to curse you or be angry with you, but that's your decision. This is the method to become Krishna conscious. The guru is simply explaining the methodology of making advancement in Krishna consciousness. It's not that he's doing it for his benefit. Like the parent sometimes will be telling the child to do something for their benefit. Right? I think Adi Purusha understands this. You know, the parent is thinking, oh, you should get more education, you should become a doctor. I have friends who forced their child to become a doctor, and the child didn't want to become a doctor, and as soon as the child became a doctor, the child said, I'm not going to be a doctor. I went to medical school and graduated and everything because of you, Mom, but now I'm going to do what I actually want to do, join the Hare Krishna movement. So, so anyway, the guru's business is simply to explain how to become Krishna conscious, guide the disciple, and if the disciple decides not to follow that guidance, the guru maintains his compassion. He doesn't curse the disciple. He's not like Durvasa Muni. That if Durvasa Muni was upset with one of his disciples, I haven't heard any stories about that. But he was even upset with Maharaj Ambarish, you know, because Maharaj Ambarish took some water before Durvasa Muni had a chance to take prasadam, and he was ready to curse him. He did curse him. He tried to kill him. So the guru is not like that. The guru has to be here, you know, here's the method, and if you accept this much, this is the result you get, and if you accept that much, that's the result you get. If you want to go back to Godhead, here's the way to do it. If you want to stay in the material world, here's the way to do it. You understand? And but the guru really wants the disciple to go back to home, back to Godhead, to take the fast path. But at the same time, he's not invested, let's say, personally in it, in the sense that it's gonna destroy his life. It's not like the parent who's trying to manipulate the child. How can you do this to me? You didn't go to Mangalarti. You're a disgrace to your guru. Like a parent says to someone, this is really pointed. Like your wife doesn't have a PhD. So it's important that relationships be actually based on care, and we give people the freedom to make their own choices, and even the freedom to make the wrong choice in their life. That's the freedom. But we have to explain what is the wrong choice and what is the right choice. That's all. And it's up to them. Yeah, it's a very detached, and that's compassion. We can't be manipulating people. I mean, too many times we have in religious societies the idea of manipulating people either by threats, punishment, guilt trips. And in Christianity, you have preachers tell people, if you don't do this, you're going to hell, you're going to burn in the hell fires. We can't do that. You know, tricks. I remember years ago there used to be this new Bhakta handbook. How do you make new devotees in the Krishna conscious movement? First of all, you get them to stay overnight at the temple. And the way you get them to stay overnight at the temple is when they come to the Sunday feast, you disable their car so they can't live.
Oh my God.
It was actually there. It actually told you how to do it. It said, you take the spark plug wires out of the car. And so that way you get a certain amount of bhakta points.
Or you gave them so much prasadam that they can't
leave. But you get a certain amount of bhakta points for one night stay at the temple. You get certain more bhakta points for shaving their hair. I mean, this is just so manipulative. We're offering something so nice. Our only business is to offer it to people, and they'll naturally accept it if we are loving with them, if we're compassionate with them, if we're empathic with them, And we're not forcing or manipulating them. We're acting in a trustworthy fashion. And they can, you know, they can feel that. People can feel that. I think that's really important as far as reaching out, or don't want to use the word preaching, but as far as giving people Krishna consciousness or sharing Krishna consciousness, as people have to feel that we really care and we're giving them a choice. And if people choose to do something, they stick in Krishna consciousness. Okay, very important point. Free will, choice, and dealing with people. And we respect their decision. You know, if someone says, you know, I just want to be, just want to eat meat. I say, all right, that's not all right. But you understand the result from it, that's all. That's up to you. That's up to you. That's my preaching. I just explained to people the natural repercussions of each particular action. And even parents and children can do that too. Let's say you want your child to go to school. You don't threaten him or her with taking away food, especially food.
Oh my God.
You don't want to do that. You know, if you don't go to school, you don't get any cookies. If you go to school, you get cookies. Like my mother said, that if you go to school and you do well in school, I'll give you money for each A that you get, a little less money for each B, no money for a C, negative amount for a D. But you explain the natural repercussions and let them make the decision. And you say, look, if you don't go to school and if you don't get educated, then your life will not be so pleasant. You're going to be cleaning houses for the rest of your life or something like that. And they may decide to do that. Actually, Prabhupada never wanted to go to school, but his mother had to force him. I mean, sometimes you have to take kids to school. You can't just let them play all the time. But at least there has to be an effort to explain to children and others the natural repercussions for a particular course of action, so that people have an opportunity to make their own decisions. Very important. So let's talk about something that's called the blocks of communication, things that block our communication. These are called the four D's of discommunication, things that interfere with our relating to each other. And these four are as follows, and I'm going to explain each one. One is called diagnosis, the other one is denial, demand, and deserve. And although these block communication, we should not think that these are bad, because these indicate needs or feelings that we have. We want to get away from thinking that even judgmental language is bad. It's useful. Anger is not bad. So we try to get away from this bad and good dichotomy, because any feelings we have or any diagnoses we have, like right here, indicate something deeper going on. Like if we call, let's say I call him a demon, what does that indicate?
Is
it a demon?
Is there a need?
No, it indicates, it may indicate that I have a need to have a close relationship with you. It may indicate that I'm not really in touch with my Krishna consciousness. It may indicate that I'm angry. Like when Prabhupada calls people demons, it may indicate that he has a need to clarify the philosophy. It may indicate a whole bunch of different things. So even when people use judgmental language, the judgmental language may indicate, or does indicate, something deeper going on. Something that needs perhaps needs to be dealt with, needs to be fixed, needs to, we need to be aware of. It's so we don't want to say that something is bad in terms of the judgmental language. It's actually useful to indicate some underlying need, feeling and need. So let's go to the four D's of discommunication or disconnection. The first one we already talked about, which is diagnosis. Diagnosis means to give someone a static label, such as the ones we see over there. And their expressions, when we do that, they're expressions of unmet needs. Like if I call him a demon, the expression, as we mentioned before, the expression could be that I have an unmet need for understanding him, unmet need for connecting to Krishna, any one of a number of unmet needs. They're tragic expressions. You could say they're tragic expressions. But they're expressions of something else that we need to become aware of. So when we do that, it's not that we beat ourselves up for doing that. We try to understand why we're using those particular designations. You know, why did I use that designation? Why did I call him a demon? Why did I call Adipurusha a demon? You know, that's, I'm not asking for an answer. So I try to understand that in terms of feelings and needs. Because the underlying understanding of empathic communication is that all actions and feelings that we have are due to needs that are met or unmet. And what are needs? We talked about this morning in class. Needs are basic things that, what do we need? And this understanding of needs is taken from a particular psychologist named Maslow, who talked about a hierarchy of needs. Hierarchy of needs means the basic things like food, water, light, space, friendship, autonomy, play, recreation, understanding, and ultimately Krishna consciousness or self-actualization. And every one of us has these needs. Every one of us has these needs. And these needs are at the basis or foundation of every single feeling we have or every single action we have. That's a really important point to understand in terms of empathic communication. Anytime we feel anything, or feel in a certain way, or act in a certain way, those actions and feelings come from needs that are met or not being met. Like if I, for example, if I yell at Adipurusha, what could be the underlying need? Hungry. Underlying, or it could be underlying need of friendship or connection or any of these needs. It could be any one of a number of needs. So every action that any of us executes is due to needs met or unmet. Can anyone think of an action that might not be met to needs met or unmet? Give me an example and I'll explain it.
Any action?
Any action, yeah. Or thought.
That might not have been
that is not connected. Can you think of any? Can anyone think of any? Everything we do is motivated by needs. Every word that we speak,
of course, duty.
Yes, yeah, so, all right, so duty. So if one is acting out of duty, mm-hmm. then one has a need for what?
Mm-hmm.
Reliability. Well, it could be reliability, connection. Let's say I have a duty to wake up early for Mangalarti. So so that's out of a need for connection to Krishna, become Krishna conscious. If you go down, if you drill down on duty, it's always connected to a need. Stability, yeah.
What may have been Bhishma's need that he chose, even though he was very affectionate to other side, but he chose
to fight on the wrong side. Bhishma's need could have been a sense of truthfulness, duty, because there's duty again, connection to his father, Shantanu, he took that vow in relationship with his father, a sense of self-worth, because he identified himself as a truthful person. So there's a need for self-worth. The people feel, self-esteem, self-worth. And in that society, Dharma was considered, or being considered a Dharmic person was actually considered very important. Need for truthfulness, a need for sticking to one's promises. Integrity, yeah, that's right, integrity. A need for integrity. So definitely he was functioning to fulfill certain needs. And of course later on he realized it was wrong. Later on when he was on the bed of arrows, he realized he did the wrong thing. What's that? Yeah, sure.
So is it that these were not only needs that he had, he also probably knows that he had needs to be loving and caring towards his fellow ones. So somehow other he prioritized in this situation.
He prioritized that need and wasn't loving towards the Pandavas. And so he was in a conflict situation.
He put some on the shelf
and it was a conflict situation and he was pain the whole time.
Yeah.
He was, because when you're acting to fulfill your needs, most likely you'll be happy, but he wasn't happy.
Yeah.
So what I mentioned this morning is that one has to consider all of one's needs. And oftentimes when I'm speaking about situations like that, I talk about thinking outside the box. How could he, here's an interesting question based on the question you just raised. How could he have fulfilled all of his needs? Can anyone answer that? I mean, I don't even know that. But
by trying to do what Krishna wants, that would ultimately satisfy him.
But what about his need for sticking to his, for integrity? Because in his culture, part of his identity is keeping his promise.
But then it's the higher.
Yeah, I understand that, but that would conflict with his other need. Isn't it? I mean, he has these cultural needs too. So if he tries to satisfy the need of pleasing Krishna, and these other needs are neglected, I mean, it's so much ingrained in his psychology, the cultural needs, right? His sense of identity. So how, this is an interesting exercise, very interesting exercise. Thank you for bringing that up. So how could he fulfill his needs without conflicting with other needs. What could Bhishma Deva have done? Any ideas? I mean, I don't have a clear idea right now. What's that?
Maybe it's good to have for homework. It's
for homework.
Deep thing.
Okay, here's a suggestion. For homework, we're going to come up with suggestions for Grandfather Bhishma.
Yeah.
What could he have done to fulfill all of his needs, or at least not to conflict with any of his needs, when he was confronted with the situation where he was ordered by Duryodhana to fight the Pandavas? Because he was in so much conflict. Because you can see his conflict, because even when he was ordered by Duryodhana to fight the Pandavas, he didn't fight seriously. I mean, there was one time Duryodhana came to him and said, "You're not fighting seriously. You know, you're not acting properly." And then Grandfather Bhishma took out 5 arrows and he said, "With these 5 arrows, I'm going to kill the 5 Pandavas tomorrow." And then Krishna had to make a trick to have Arjuna ask for those 5 arrows from Duryodhana, who was holding these 5 arrows. So you can see he's in constant conflict and pain throughout the whole battle of Kurukshetra. And I'm not talking just about him lying down on the battle of the bed of arrows, but he was in constant conflict. So that means he wasn't meeting his needs. So that's a homework assignment.
I mean, like, what if he got, by having a higher understanding of things and seeing, like, the highest dharma is to serve Krishna, like, wouldn't the strategies he uses to fulfill his needs, like, by serving Krishna, he could meet the same needs he's trying to meet, just, he changes his outlook.
But remember, he's a Kshatriya. I mean, that's a designation. But remember, there are different natures. Mm. And for one who has been honored, dishonor is worse than death. Mm. So there's a need for, I wouldn't say exactly being honored, but there's a need for integrity, you know. Mm. This is my identity, you know. I'm telling the truth. I'm keeping my vows. So how could he keep his vow on that level and also be empathic with the Pandavas and listen to Krishna simultaneously? And you find these conflicts presented, sometimes they're resolved in win-win ways in the Bhagavatam. For example, when Ashwatthama killed the 5 sleeping sons of Draupadi and the Pandavas, then you have Bhimsen wanting to kill Ashwatthama, and Krishna first telling Arjuna to kill him, and Arjuna confronted with this conflict, this that you kill him, but you're not supposed to kill him. You can't kill a Brahmin. His mother is still alive. She's depending on him. Creepy was his mother. So how do you resolve this particular conflict? And of course, the Pandavas were able to resolve, Arjuna was able to resolve that conflict very nicely. By, you know, cutting the jewel out like that. And then Krishna, of course, cursed him to smell bad for 5,000 years. That so there's all these stories about conflicts that are resolved in win-win ways in the Bhagavatam. So there must be a way that Grandfather Bhishma could have resolved it. Of course, that wasn't Krishna's plan. On another level, it wasn't Krishna's plan that it would be resolved. Because Krishna's plan was that he wanted all these Kshatriyas to be killed in the battle of Kurukshetra. Interesting. Interesting question. So let's think about it. How could he have resolved this? I have no idea.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It comes to mind Karna, who had an interesting way of resolving, like, the... He told Kunti, like, at the end of this... Like,
you'll have 5 sons alive.
Yeah. So, I mean, somehow that comes to mind. It's interesting.
But it still meant he was going to kill one of his brothers. So you still have a conflict there.
Well, I guess one's better than five.
That's not precisely a win-win. So you have to think about that. You know, he had to kill one of his brothers, or he was thinking he was going to kill one of his brothers. Okay. So, anyway. So, talking about the four D's of discommunication, we mentioned before diagnosis, which are judgments and their tragic expressions of unmet needs. We went over that before. You went over static versus process language. Okay, so let me do an exercise right now to show you how important it is to avoid diagnosing people. Let me pick another victim now. Who wants to be a victim?
I could try.
No, I can't do that to you. Too respectable. Okay, let's use a positive label. It's very respectable senior lady.
Oh, that's embarrassing.
So how do you okay, how do you feel that you've been labeled a respectable senior lady?
Embarrassed.
Okay, so how does everyone feel when they see her now that I'm putting the label on her? You feel any different? What?
Feeling respect. Yeah.
Feeling respect. Yeah. That's pretty good. See, it works.
Probably because you said that?
Yeah, because I'm an authority.
Yes.
And I said that she's a senior, respectable lady. So you see her like that. In terms of the words.
Because you said it.
I know. That's the authority structure. That's the domination culture right there. Or, let me give another one. Listen, who can I insult? No, I better not do that with Gora. Really
you can insult me.
Let me try Abby Purusha. He's the only one I can get away with. You're a fanatic devotee.
Probably some truth to that.
Just fanatic. You know, you're not in touch with your needs. You're not in touch with anything. And the only reason I got you married was to teach you that you're a human being. Teach you to have some feelings, that you're always in a robot mode. You think you can be Krishna conscious by being ritualistic. He's fanatic. Yeah, he would go out to the university and tell people they're like hogs, dogs, camels, and asses. It's real, it's true. So how do you feel about him now?
Better.
Better? You like him more. But you see him like that, you put a label. Actually, the way we used to do this in our seminars is that we would take a post-it note, and we'd stick it on people's foreheads, and it would say, people didn't know what was on their forehead. It would say, idiot, fanatic, stupid, intelligent, like that, and the people would relate to each other like that. So like Prabhupada would say, what, you give the dog a bad name and hang him. So in other words, we tend to do that with people and then we relate to them in that particular way. So, anyone have any questions about that?
What is usually found in this giving labels?
The be giving labels to others. It depends on the label that we're giving. You know, protection, understanding. Maybe our training and our culture.
Behind the negative
ones? Because it may help with our own self-esteem to put other people down. Like we see, sometimes, all right, here's something, that sometimes devotees are accused of being envious because they criticize others. But it's not precisely envy. It's just that they're trying to protect themselves or trying to feel better about themselves or self-esteem. Yeah, it's a way of defending ourselves. It's a way of feeling better about ourselves. It's not that someone is necessarily envious per se, because envious means we want something that someone else has. We tend to put that label on people, that you're envious or I'm envious, but actually I'm just trying to feel better about myself. That I, you know, it's a need for self-esteem. That's very important. We have to have a positive attitude towards ourselves. I once wrote an article for some ISKCON publication, and the article was entitled "Love Yourself," and I got criticized for it. Because I said that, you know, Krishna says we should love all living entities. And we're one of the living entities. So we should love ourselves, too. And Krishna loves us. I'm not talking about, you know, just loving the body and looking in the mirror on the wall, who's the greatest devotee of them all. But to really, you know, love yourself, feel positively about yourself. And we often tend to think that humility means to think less of yourself. That's not humility. Humility, of course, sometimes I say humility means to think of yourself less. But thinking less of yourself means to think of yourself more. You know, I'm a rascal. Like Prabhupada, one time when someone said, I'm the most fallen, Prabhupada said, you're not the most anything. So true humility means to understand your identity as part and parcel of Krishna, Jivetas, and the boy, Nitya Krishna Das. Gopi Bharta Padakamala, Dasa Dasa, Dasana Dasa. To think you're a servant of a servant of a servant, the Lord maintains the gopis of Vrindavan. That's your identity. And you love yourself. Take care of your needs. You love yourself because Krishna loves you. He loves all living entities. And so, why not? But if you say this in many places to devotees, you should love yourself. That's false ego. And you should meet your needs because you're a spirit soul. You're part and parcel of Krishna, so obviously you should love yourself. So anyway, so if I call him a rascal, demon, whatever like that, let's say I'm envious. Oh, he has such a nice wife. I'm not envious of that. Anyway, so let me think of something. He has such a nice car. I remember the first time he came to the temple. I said, what are you doing with such a nice car? And he said, I have rich parents. And I said, phew. I'm supposed to be the guru, and he has a better car than me. So what need, here's a question for all of you. What need, you know, I was feeling unhappy because I was feeling unhappy, stimulated by the fact that he had a better car than me. What need was I trying to?
For self-esteem.
Self-worth,
yeah.
Because we identify in our culture with the type of car you have. But I wasn't actually envious of him. There was some need for self-worth, or...
Mm.
Yeah. Because I'm his guru, and he's driving around a better car than me. So to fulfill that need, I got a better car than him. That was my strategy. Yeah.
What's a real life?
Maybe some unfulfilled need. Yeah, unfulfilled. Yeah, unfulfilled need. Definitely unfulfilled.
I don't
need.
Have such a good car. I would like to have it, but I don't have it.
Yeah. It's an unfulfilled need. Well, it's not a need to have a good car. But there's a need for feeling some self-worth. Yeah, what's the question?
What's like a real-life example of like real envy?
Real envy would be animal killing, eating animals.
Mm-hmm.
Probably describe it like that. Because you want something that someone else has. Not that it's just an unfulfilled need. You just actually want to possess someone and control someone.
But doesn't that come from a need as well? Or no?
Well, everything is covered by needs, yeah. Yeah, you could say, the underlying need for wanting to possess and control someone is a self-worth or something like that. But I would say envy means, like Prabhupada defined animal killing as envy. So envy would be really wanting to possess what someone else has. I didn't want to possess his car. I wanted a better one. So, yeah, it basically when we try to control people and use people or possess what they have or possess them, that's actually envy. When two people try to possess each other, control each other. When you want something that someone else has, That's what envy is. Whether it's their body in the case of an animal, or I didn't want his car, that's for sure.
It's like something more specific, like they're very intelligent, so I'm going to use them for their intelligence because I don't have it. Or like, but if it was self-esteem, it'd be like, wow, they're very intelligent. I feel bad about.
Yeah, self-esteem would be they're very, very intelligent and. You know, I just want to, like right now I'm dumb. You know, anyways, I want to be intelligent too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a sense of self-esteem.
Yeah.
I guess they're connected. Envy basically means to feel bad about what someone else has. I mean, it's a dictionary definition.
Mm.
Prabhupada took it as wanting to have something that someone else has.
I heard a distinction drawn between like jealousy and envy. Like envy, you want someone else to lose something, and jealousy is like you want something that someone has. I don't know if that's...
I don't know.
I don't know how I've heard that.
I don't know. It's hard to say. Sorry to say. Anyway, it's linguistics. Okay. So, we talked about diagnosis. Let's get to the second D of discommunication, which is called denial of responsibility, which is a big one. Denial of responsibility is that we blame our own feelings, needs, actions upon some outside force. For example, here's some examples. It's your fault that I am miserable. Or I drink because I'm an alcoholic. That's a big one. I lied because the temple president told me to lie. I got angry because I'm a conditioned soul. That's a big one. Or like the Nazis... I was just following orders. So denial of your own responsibility for your actions, feelings, and needs. Krishna always gives a choice. We always have a choice in every circumstance as to our course of action. If someone puts angry because you made me angry, or I overate, because I'm, as I mentioned before, conditioned soul, I overate because I don't have control of my senses. You know, we have so many excuses for our actions. So the whole idea is to take personal responsibility for our actions. In each and every case, we're choosing to do something rather than being forced. I mean, no one, in most circumstances, I mean, obviously, I'm using the gun example again, but no one is actually forced to do things. But we often feel that we're being forced. But we have to imbibe that whole mood of choice. Like, you know, another example of Adi Purusha again, I like picking on him. He can say, you know, you force me to get married. Is that true?
Persuasive arguments in favor of why I should get married.
He said, I want to be a brahmachari. And I said, no way. And I said, I'll introduce, we'll have a swayamvara. You know what a swayamvara is? A reverse swayamvara.
Oh.
And then we'll, anyway. But I didn't, and he chose, even though it may appear, that I ordered him. Here's this nice girl, you must get married to her. No, I didn't say that. But he chose. I mean, I didn't really force you, did I?
Not really.
I actually suggested him, I said, you better be married. And he was first saying, I want to be a brahmachari, I want to be a brahmachari. I said, I think you should get married. And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. It wasn't much of a, didn't take much persuasion to persuade him. But he chose. You and I suggested, but he's responsible for his choice. He can't blame me later on. So we have to take responsibility for what we do in life. And oftentimes, you know, we say, you made me angry, you did this, you did that. And we have to just say, you know, I chose to be angry. We should preface our statement by, I chose to be angry. I mean, maybe what you did stimulated me in being angry, but you're not responsible for it. It's my strategy to fulfill a particular need. I chose to be angry. So this is the block of communication. Okay. So let's go around the room. And I want to hear some examples of things that you have to do that you're not choosing to do. Anybody? And then we'll change them to choosing to do.
I have to go to work.
You have to go to work?
Yes.
Why?
To get money.
So, you have to go. That's interesting. How do you feel when you use that language?
Fortunately, I have a job which I like.
Oh, you like, so you're choosing. You're choosing to go to work, why?
To learn things which I need for my life.
Good. And also, you're getting money too, right?
Yes.
So you need to support yourself, so you're choosing to do that. So let's examine the difference between your saying, I have to go to work, and choosing to go to work. So you're choosing to go to work to meet certain needs, right? What would happen if you chose not to go to work?
I My husband would have to go.
That's better. So, if you chose not to go to work, you could choose, right?
Yes.
And you could choose, you are choosing to go to work. So you don't really have to go to work, do you? So how do you feel about expressing it as choosing to go to work versus having to go to work or forced to go to work?
Choosing is much better.
Much better.
Yeah.
So that's the point. And you actually are choosing.
Yeah.
Not, you know, you could choose not to. Who else is forced to do something or has to do something?
I had to go to the hospital.
Why?
Because I broke my leg.
Broke your leg?
Mm-hmm.
Could you choose not to go to the hospital?
No.
No?
No, how?
Why are you choosing to go? Why are you going to the hospital?
Because they are the only one who will fix this.
Will fix it?
Yeah.
So you want to get it fixed, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And if you didn't go, what would happen? You wouldn't get it fixed.
No, yes.
So you want to get it fixed. But nobody's forcing you to go to the hospital, right?
Yes, that's true.
So you're choosing to go to the hospital, why?
Because I want to have a fixed leg.
You want to have a leg that works.
Yes.
You want to be functional. You want mobility.
Yeah.
You want your independence.
Yeah.
You don't want to be so dependent on Gora.
Yeah. Not to be anymore, yeah.
Yeah, because right now that your leg isn't working or your foot isn't working so well, you're more dependent on him. So you need more independence, right?
Yeah,
that's right. See? So you're choosing to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
You don't really have to.
No, that's true.
If you didn't go to the hospital and the leg remained really bad, then you wouldn't have your independence anymore.
That's true.
You'd be subject to his control all the time.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be so nice, would it?
No.
So you're choosing. You're choosing to go for this reason, but you have a choice not to go. The point is you have the choice not to go. Who else would like to volunteer?
I want one little bit.
Yeah.
Kids have to go to school. I mean, they can be at home, but they still have to study and do the exam.
Why?
I mean, it is obviously good for them, but they don't have choice.
They don't have a choice?
Yeah.
Well, you as a parent have the need for your kids being functional in society, right? Well, what would happen if you didn't have the kids go to school? They take away the kids. So you're choosing.
Oh, you're choosing to do this social because you took them away.
Like I said, you know, sometimes it's an obvious choice. Like if someone has a gun to your head, that's an obvious choice, but you're choosing to do that. And you actually feel better when you phrase it as choosing. Even with a gun to the head, you feel better. I'm choosing life. Mm-hmm. Right? If you phrase it as choosing, even a miserable circumstance like losing your money becomes more pleasant because I'm choosing to remain alive. You know, just like I give the example, when I got a traffic citation for speeding, I chose to hire a lawyer. Why did I choose to North Carolina is choosing to go to the orthodontist. You know what an orthodontist is? Those are the types of yamadutas that put things on your teeth to straighten them up for like 10 years or 15 years of torture. So when I was young, my mother forced me, it wasn't choice, to go to the orthodontist. And I had 10 years of pain from it. Okay, that's me. I didn't choose. I was forced. That's true. And I just didn't have the freedom to not do it. But there's this girl in North Carolina who's choosing to go, you know who it is, to go to the orthodontist because she wants to have a beautiful smile so that she will be attractive. So she's very happy about going to the orthodontist in spite of being in so much pain for years. So it's a question of rephrasing it in your mind. So everything we choose to do, if we rephrase in our minds, instead of thinking I'm forced to do this, then it becomes much more pleasant. You have to go.
Girdari, the train station.
Oh, Girdari's coming.
Yeah.
Okay. We're almost finished anyway. It's almost 1 o'clock. Yeah.
There's actually a video I had in one of my my courses in college that taught this. Mm-hmm. It's called You Pack Your Own Shoe, which is sort of like a metaphor, but in the video it wasn't a metaphor. She was going skydiving. But it was like, you are the one that makes yourself or chooses to feel the way that you feel, not anyone else.
Yeah. Really good about it. Because it was had to, you know, I did things like writing notes on the blackboard with a funny picture of the teacher. I did things like putting a poo-poo bag under the teacher's seat, if you don't know what that is. It's a bag that makes a funny noise, like someone is passing air under the teacher's seat. I put devices that would give the teacher shocks.
Oh my God.
On the teacher's desk. Because, you know, it's just, you rebel. The nature, our nature is that when we have to do something, we want to rebel against it. Especially when in the authority.